The next area addressed by the think tank group was the use of EGFR inhibitors, and Dr. Neil Maripol began the discussion by commenting on a paper from ASCO on a CALGB trial evaluating cetuximab combined with first-line chemotherapy and a number of other papers studying tissue predictors of response to EGFR inhibitors. Dr. Maripol began by providing some perspective on this treatment strategy.
Where we stand right now is that we know that cetuximab and panitumumab have modest activity as single agents in refractory colon cancer. We know that when you add irinotecan to cetuximab, it's more active than giving cetuximab alone in metastatic disease. And we're now gaining some new information regarding the refinement of first-line use of these agents. But patient selection for the use of EGFR inhibitors remains a relative mystery. So in terms of helping define the first-line role, I'd like to briefly review the presentation from ASCO of CALGB 80203 presented by Alan Vinook. In 80203, there was an initial randomization to either FOLFIRI or FOLFOX, and then a subsequent randomization to receive either cetuximab or not to receive cetuximab. Now, the primary endpoint of the study was overall survival, looking for an improvement in overall survival with the use of cetuximab. But because of poor accrual, the study was discontinued after enrollment of about 200 patients. The poor accrual related in part to the acceptance of bevacizumab as a component of frontline therapy for most patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. To summarize the data with between 53 and 58 patients per arm, when one looks at the response rates with the addition of cetuximab, there appears to be an improvement in response rate when cetuximab is added to either FOLFIRI or FOLFOX, with response rates with chemotherapy alone being either 36 or 40%. With chemotherapy, FOLFIRI and FOLFOX respectively, and going up to 44% or 60% when adding cetuximab. And if one pools the results for the two chemotherapy groups, in patients just getting chemotherapy, the response rate was 38%, and in those getting cetuximab, it was 52%, and this difference was statistically significant. When one looks at progression-free survival by treatment arms, the curves clump together and essentially overlap. It's really difficult to make any conclusions about this given the small number of patients, and it's really difficult to hazard a guess with regard to treatment effect in terms of whether cetuximab improves outcome with FOLFIRI better or worse than with FOLFOX. So I'm not going to try and make something there because of the small numbers. And we've already heard today about the follow-up study, which will be looking at a randomization between either cetuximab, bevacizumab, or the combination of both antibodies in combination with chemotherapy, which the chemotherapy backbone being based on patient or physician choice. Now, what about selecting patients for EGFR antibody therapy? Do we have any predictive markers we can use at this point? The initial studies with cetuximab and panitumumab required that the tumors were EGFR positive as measured by immunohistochemistry. But among these studies, the degree of positivity had no relationship whatsoever with the likelihood of responding or surviving with antibody therapy. And this raised the question as to whether those patients who have absolutely no staining for EGFR might also benefit. And the first experience to shed some light on this, or an early experience, was reported by Chung in the Journal of Clinical Oncology last year, which was a single institution chart review of 16 patients who had so-called EGFR negative tumors by immunohistochemistry. And 14 of the 16 had received cetuximab in combination with irinotecan, 2 received cetuximab alone. And in this group of 16 patients, there were 4 partial responses observed, and this provides proof of principle that immunohistochemistry may not be entirely reliable in excluding those patients who might not benefit from cetuximab. There are also some similar data from panitumumab monotherapy, and these data include a study of 23 patients treated with panitumumab monotherapy every other week. And of these 23 patients, 3 of them responded with partial responses to treatment for a 13% response rate, again demonstrating that with no EGFR positivity, there could be a response rate. And actually, these were patients with 0 to 9% positivity, so low positivity of EGFR. Now, what are the limitations for immunohistochemistry? Well, the sensitivity of the assay is not complete in that there's a level of EGFR expression below which the stain will not be positive. There's discordance between primary tumors and metastatic tumors with regard to EGFR expression. Older specimens might have degradation of the protein and be falsely negative. There are issues related to the quality control of the assay, what reagents you select. And from pathologist to pathologist, there's inter-observer variability in interpreting the results of staining. And this last point is highlighted by an abstract submitted for ASCO, but not presented, just published in the abstract book, of a study in which patients were screened for EGFR negativity to prospectively address the question formally of what is the response rate in an EGFR negative population by immunohistochemistry. And of the patients screened for this study, 110 patients, about half of them were initially identified by the local physician as being EGFR negative. When these tumors were then subsequently submitted for further central review, about half of them ended up being EGFR positive when retested at a central lab. So this gives you the idea that it is operator dependent, and also a different cut of the tumor block might have a different result in terms of EGFR staining. So this has led us to basically dispense with the notion that immunohistochemistry should be used as a screening test for selecting patients for treatment with EGFR inhibitor antibodies. So what are some mechanisms of the activation of EGFR that might give us clues that we should pursue in terms of identifying predictive markers? Well, there are potential differences in receptor expression, gene amplification for the EGFR, activating mutations in the EGFR that might make it more prone to inhibition or more prone to being a dependent pathway for survival in that tumor, differences in ligand expression, and loss of negative regulation such as phosphatase levels in tumors. And it should be noted that an antibody such as cetuximab may have mechanisms of action other than just perturbing signaling. So cetuximab has the potential to participate in ADCC, and this mechanism, if it exists, may allow for different types of predictive markers. And one study presented at ASCO this year looked at polymorphisms in the Fc gamma receptor, which might impact the binding of cetuximab and its participation in ADCC. Other clues come from a study by Maroney in The Lancet in 2005, suggesting that EGFR gene amplification is related to response. There have been subsequent data that have not been as supportive of this, but it remains a hypothesis worth testing. And more recent data presented in Cancer Research showing that RAS gene mutations confer resistance or are associated with resistance to cetuximab therapy, which makes sense because if RAS is activated, this is a downstream action that would therefore bypass the effect or any action going on at the level of the receptor. So it may be that tumors with RAS gene mutations should not be offered therapy with cetuximab. Now, earlier today, there was some discussion about the cost of these drugs, and I just want to make the point that one way to control cost of cancer therapy is to improve patient selection, and that this is really a critical mechanism that we as practicing oncology community can adhere to and promote. I don't think it's our role at an individual level to attempt to control societal costs when faced with an individual patient in whom we think a particular therapy might be beneficial. However, it is our responsibility to define and encourage evidence-based practice and to define populations most likely to benefit from particular treatments. And so it's critical that we enroll our patients on clinical trials that will address these issues.
Lee, any thoughts about where this is heading?
The bypass mechanisms that Neil talked about makes biologic sense, and now you've got clinical evidence, because by inhibiting EGFR signaling at the surface, you're not going to do any good if you have aberrant signaling intracellularly. So you already have an activated tumor cell regardless of what's on the surface. So it makes sense that EGFR inhibitors would not be a benefit in that situation.
The next three papers were discussed by Dr. Jordan Berlin and focused on panitumumab, the fully human monoclonal antibody which targets the epidermal growth factor receptor. The first study was reported by Dr. Berlin, a phase 2 trial of 91 patients with metastatic disease progressing on irinotecan, oxaliplatin, and 5-FU.
Median time since diagnosis of metastases was 20 months. So before they got to their third line therapy, they were already alive for a median survival of 20 months. Some of the patients had even received four lines of therapy previously, although three lines of therapy was maximum eligible. The results showed that the overall response rate was 8%, stable disease 21%, progression-free survival 7.6 weeks. And basically, in the context, I really think this is fairly similar. The Bond subset treated with all three drugs, according to the New England Journal of Medicine paper, was 8.5% response rate, and the progression-free survival for the overall group on single-agent cetuximab was similar at 1.5 months. The HEC trial, which had the lower non-expressors up to 10%, basically had a response rate of 8% for the low and 18% for the non-expressors. That's one in two responses, by the way. And consistently on single-agent cetuximab or panitumumab is you have at the first data analysis point a huge drop-off, basically saying there's a huge number of patients who don't get a thing out of this, and then there's a group that does. The Peters trial was actually a randomized trial of the same panitumumab regimen, 6 milligrams per kilogram given every other week, versus best supportive care. I like the fact they put in plus best supportive care. And, of course, this allowed crossover to the panitumumab upon progressive disease, an important issue in the trial. So it was a one-to-one randomization. Their primary endpoint was progression-free survival on blinded review. Same eligibility as the trial I just showed you, except the EGFR had to be at least 1%, so there was no completely negative patients on there. And basically, their primary endpoint was a 33% reduction in the overall disease progression rate compared to best supportive care. They had a 90% power to detect this. Their goal was 362 of patients with progressive disease or death. And so they felt that they needed 430 patients. And that's what they got. Actually, they got 463 patients. Pretty well balanced, male to female, and all the various things they looked at, including number of metastatic sites and number of prior regimens, including prior adjuvant therapy. What they showed was a statistically significant improvement in the hazard ratio, 0.54, for progression-free survival, suggesting that panitumumab prevents progression. Although, look at the progression-free survival curves again. Both best supportive care and the panitumumab show this huge drop-off. It also shows you that there's probably this little group of patients that are actually fairly stable and could have stayed on. So the curve that shows people who are benefiting also includes a group of people who probably would have been fine on best supportive care and weren't progressing that rapidly to start with. Regardless, the response rate, 8%, is the same. Overall survival was identical between the two arms. 174 of the 232 patients on best supportive care did cross over to panitumumab. The strengths of this trial, randomized with central review, it was a large study. Progression-free survival is still a soft endpoint, even with central review, because the investigators may be highly motivated, since you can't blind a person to a drug that causes 90% of the patients to develop a very characteristic rash. People who know that their patients on the best supportive care may be more motivated to look if there's the least bit of a symptom for the evidence of progressive disease and then call them progression and put them on the crossover. And the crossover negates the survival data. Just so you know, 10% of the crossover patients actually responded to the panitumumab. And then the last issue was the panitumumab trial combining with irinotecan 5-FU leucovorin. And this was a trial we started several years ago with panitumumab plus irinotecan 5-FU leucovorin using the IFL regimen and then moved it to a FOLFIRI regimen. We had 19 patients on the IFL plus panitumumab. This time we were doing weekly dosing. We have to have about 30-month follow-up at this point, at least. Bottom line was that median follow-up, again, 16.2 months. Grade 3-4 diarrhea on the IFL plus panitumumab was very high, 47%, with two people dying on that of the diarrhea-related toxicity. FOLFIRI plus panitumumab was much more reasonable at 13%. Response rate on IFL plus panitumumab was very good at 47%. Can't tell you why, but we had a low response rate on the FOLFIRI plus panitumumab, but we had a great progression-free survival at 10.9 months. And there was only one death. It's my patient. It's not related to drug. She had rapidly progressive disease, unfortunately. So in the context, these are two small phase 2 studies. IFL was too toxic. We had two deaths and a lot of people hospitalized. The FOLFIRI definitely had a promising progression-free survival, your typical line at the end of every ASCO abstract, and reasonable toxicity profile, but the rash is a significant stigma, especially in first line. And it's uncertain how to define this, as mentioned earlier, in the era of chemotherapy-free intervals, how you define what to do with something like a biologic agent, since we don't know how those work into that.
Can you comment on the PACE study?
So the PACE study is randomization of FOLFIRI or FOLFOX dealer's choice with bevacizumab, with or without panitumumab, and the PACE trial, I understand, is accruing very well. It's going to be an interesting trial because the primary endpoint is actually progression-free survival, but it is powered to be able to look at overall survival, which was the conclusion of that colorectal cancer endpoints meeting that Al and I'm not sure how many other people here attended for the FDA.
When is it expected that we'll have data from that?
Well, the last I heard, it sounded like it was getting close to completing accrual by the end of this year.
Question for Jordan on the Peters presentation. What proportion of patients crossed over? I saw it was 174 of the people who were assigned to best supportive care. What proportion was that of the total BSC patients?
174 of 232. I'd have to do the math.
Did they analyze outcomes according to whether they crossed over or not?
Yes, they did. So actually, if you took out, in terms of the survival, they looked at some things. They took out the people who responded, just the 17 people who responded on that 174, and then there was this difference in the survival.
It's very hard to do that analysis because, in fact, the people who could not get crossed over by definition would have done worse, and you can't attribute it to the drug as to selection for who got treated.
That's very difficult to know.
I suspect in that big drop-down is where you could find the patients who didn't cross over.
I mean, the data show panitumumab is an active drug to the same magnitude as cetuximab. We still don't know whether this translates into overall survival. It's more like treat early or treat late. You have a rationale to observe patients and treat later. Because the patients who were treated later responded the same. Why wouldn't they? Because it's just best supportive care.
That's the amazing thing that we saw with cetuximab. I mean, I had seventh-line patients that had progressed on irinotecan. You add this drug, they start to respond again. It isn't a lot of them, but some of them really do.
Jordan, what about the issue of infusion reactions with cetuximab versus panitumumab?
Bert O'Neill at Rich's Place is actually heading up writing a paper combining data from patients treated on clinical trials at our place, Sarah Cannon, down the street from us, and at UNC. We wanted to use patients who were treated on clinical trial because we know they were uniformly graded, as opposed to the nurses saw the reaction in the clinic and then they told us about it and we decided to grade it later. So we wanted to use that as the data, and I think it's very important that several places are reporting these 10% rates. They actually fall along a very similar latitude, and we've also noted that it seems to be, at least from our state, anybody closer to sea level, the people up on the plateau, for whatever reason, so Knoxville doesn't have this problem.
I think you're more exposed to rodents.
We don't have an explanation. It's just in terms of talking to the cities.
You guys live with mice.
It's
you
not
have
living
these.
With mice. We don't
the
live chimeric, with mice.
Anti-chimeric, anti-mouse antibodies.
We have lots of rats in New York. Don't rats and mice
cross-react?
Hold
on a moment. There's another issue here. We don't see this with Rituxan. So before you accuse us of living with mice... It's a drug-specific problem. We've queried everybody. I don't know if we've queried UNC, but we've queried everybody in the Tennessee area who's reporting this, and not one has had the same problem with rituximab, which is another chimerized antibody.
Are you pre-medicating all patients every dose?
It doesn't matter, but we give them steroids the night before and the morning of, just like Taxol.
Everybody?
Wow.
Jordan, what about the severity of the infusion reaction?
We're talking grade 3, 4.
I mean, it's that high.
Every one of us has coded one of our patients or run them down the emergency room emergently. I've seen it so many times now.
And our nurses won't infuse cetuximab the first time without a physician or PA sitting next to the patient.
What about reactions to panitumumab?
Treated God knows how many patients, not a single reaction in our place. Now, it's 1% on the trials.
But not a grade 3, 4.
But not grade 3 or 4. It's 1% overall. And the other thing is, if you tease them out, it wasn't recognized by the physicians. Some of the mild reactions were only reread when they read the reports, and then the company added in based on NCI CTC criteria.
Yeah, we had this discussion on the chat room, why use panitumumab compared to cetuximab? And I think there are some advantages, which we will probably use in clinical practice. Establish Q2-week dosing. We have prospective trials on that. And then no grade 3, 4 infusion reaction makes our nurses happy. And no pre-medication required.
I misunderstood you then. I thought you were saying that you were having infusion reactions on panitumumab.
No. Just on cetuximab.
Okay, only with cetuximab. Okay.
Panitumumab, we've had zero at our place.
And that's something very different than I think anybody else's experience.
Between the trial, we've treated about 30 or 40 patients on panitumumab without a problem.
And I think the big thing to answer your question, I think, is just that, is that, again, theoretically, if this is a totally human antibody, which, again, the Xena mouse should give, it hopefully is getting away from any of the theoretical immunogenicity.
That's actually one of the reasons why I asked the question. We're using panitumumab in some of our patients as well, and I'm aware of the fact that you have none of the reactions. My concern, and perhaps I'm a little bit cynical here, is I'm not sure that competition will reduce the cost. That's a real concern I have, in that we're talking about agents
that
are...
We can only hope.
What is the payoff on the Xenomas?
I mean, when did competition reduce the cost on the antiemetics?
They just have smarter bundling.
Neil?
The big clinical question we will all be faced with when panitumumab is approved is that until we have data from the PACE study, we will have extremely limited data with regard to panitumumab in combination with chemotherapy. And so the question practicing oncologists will have to answer for themselves is whether they will be comfortable with a wholesale switch in all contexts to panitumumab, or whether one would be advised to use panitumumab as a single agent because of its demonstrated efficacy in that setting, and still use cetuximab in combination with chemotherapy where there are ample data. And I think that's a problem that we're all going to face moving forward.
Could I ask Neil how you answer your own question?
Well, I was hoping that by posing it, I wouldn't have to answer it.
And then I'm going to ask Axel, what are you going to do if and when panitumumab is available?
At this point, I'm not comfortable making a total switch in all situations to panitumumab because of the absence of data in combination with chemotherapy. So I will be comfortable with patients who would be getting monotherapy. I will be comfortable using panitumumab because of its every other week schedule and lack of infusion reactions in that setting. But in the patients who would otherwise get cetuximab with irinotecan, I'm not yet comfortable that there are ample data of chemotherapy combinations with panitumumab to make that switch for all patients.
To what extent are you seeing infusion reactions in your area, in your clinic, to cetuximab?
They're infrequent.
Axel, how do you answer that question of what are you going to do?
Outside of a clinical trial, in a palliative setting, one of my goals is not to harm any patient. I feel more rational, and I would use it off study in patients in combination with chemotherapy as a substitute for cetuximab. And coming back to the infusion reaction, we're actually going to initiate a trial in patients who have experienced sensitivity reaction to cetuximab to treat those patients with panitumumab.
So the data of FOLFIRI and panitumumab showing a response rate of 33%, that doesn't bug you at all?
No, it doesn't bug me too much in small trials. And I still believe more. I mean, it's, again, outside of clinical trial, that I think it's the same target. It's not the same drug, I agree. It's not the same area where the antibody binds. It's IgG1, IgG2 issue. But I would feel more in a palliative setting to do that. I don't know how many of you will agree to that, but I feel more comfortable doing that rather than not doing it.
I just wonder if there's going to be a correlation between how frequently you see infusion reactions and how motivated you are. So I'm asking.
You know, I can tell you that we've treated between 45 and 50 patients with cetuximab at UNC, and we've had 5 near-death experiences.
So what are you thinking you're going to do with panitumumab?
We're going to switch to panitumumab.
In the patients?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and one physician.
And one physician. You know, I was running a code with 40 people's eyes watching me on the floor of the chemo suite, and I don't ever want to do that again.
No.
They taught you how to do that at Mayo?
Dan?
It is amazing to see the difference. I mean, unless I'm completely asleep at the other end of our chemotherapy suite, we're nowhere near that rate in our institution. And we have much higher rates with oxaliplatin and taxanes than with cetuximabs. Our nurses are much more worried about them. I was going to ask Lee a preclinical question. I know the data from preclinical cell lines on the resuscitative abilities of cetuximab with irinotecan and other drugs. Are there similar, ADCC aside, similar data for panitumumab?
Can't answer that. There hasn't been a lot published on panitumumab preclinically, whereas cetuximab is throughout the literature.
Yes. I mean, if that were to exist, it would make you more comfortable making the substitution apart from the other factors.
With this argument of substituting panitumumab for cetuximab, then you could take it one step further and say tyrosine kinase inhibitors, but clearly they haven't had the same effect as the antibodies, whether that's a PK issue, a target issue, off-target issue, we don't know. Substituting one drug for another, as we've seen in the anti-VEGF field, doesn't necessarily translate into equal efficacy.
Jordan?
Dan, just so you know, we have a former fellow from Memorial Sloan Kettering who, through 3 years of fellowship, never once saw an infusion reaction at a much bigger, much more active practice, and then came to our place and basically calls our patients wimps because they keep reacting on her.
It's amazing.
It is amazing. The thing that I'm kind of curious about from the other people here is, should we be making an issue of the fact that this isn't happening with rituximab? because it's not the mouse. And that's the thing. If it were just mouse.
Well, but is it the same amount of protein that's mouse protein in rituximab?
It's about 70%, 30%.
Well, but is it the same 30%?
The normal dose is 375 weekly for
the same mouse backbone?
That's actually true. I don't know if it's IgG1. Or an IgG2.
The mouse component is completely different.
Yeah, the mouse component
is
different.
So what is the mouse component of rituximab? What percent? With rituximab, it's 10% mouse, 90% human.
The antigen binding part has to be different.
Yeah.
With rituxin, what is the amount that's mouse versus human?
The antigen binding part is the antigenic.
It's the mouse part.
It's the mouse part.
It's different between panitumab and rituximab.
Yes.
It has to be different.
It's a different part of the molecule.
Absolutely.
Norm, can you talk a little bit about the son or daughter of CO8 that's been discussed so much and the question of whether you're going to add panitumumab or cetuximab to FOLFOX-BEV?
We're certainly considering panitumumab in there. And our preference, based on how the data evolve, would be PMAB.
And are you also planning on continuing it for total duration of a year?
That's the whole issue. I mean, do we give it concomitantly with chemotherapy? Do we backload it after the chemotherapy? I mean, right now, given the fact that we're waiting for the results of PACE, there's a gap there. I mean, we would like to have some indication that PACE is going to be a positive trial. That would make life a lot easier.
Of course, if there's a potential interaction between the type of chemotherapies chosen in the PACE trial, you're going to have to do a subset analysis to see which your backbone is going to be. What if it turns out that FOLFIRI looks much better with panitumumab, but FOLFOX doesn't?
You have a real ability to pick out the most dire scenario that could possibly occur.
Then we'll have the PACE Accord 2.5 study.
Well, the most dire scenario is if PACE is completely negative.
Yeah, or if there's some quantitative interaction, it's positive.
Or quantum.
FOLFIRI and horrific negative for FOLFOX.
Mm-hmm. I hate to quench the fire a little bit, but this year at ASCO, I was impressed with the anti-EGFR trials in combination with chemotherapy, where we didn't see the response rates that we saw in the ACROBAT trial from Tabernero. So when you have more mature data, I was expecting to see response rates at least about 70%, and we were seeing response rates of about 55 to 60% with the addition of anti-EGFR to chemo at best. So as always, when you go from phase 2 to phase 3, you lose half your efficacy.
Any other concepts for next generation of clinical trials that are being discussed? Anyone want to comment on adjuvant trials?
Well, it's actually a difficult time for adjuvant trials because one of the depressing things about this year's ASCO is there weren't a whole host of drugs that I would identify as drugs 7, 8, and 9 for colorectal cancer on the horizon.
What about the rash and the two EGFR inhibitors and how you think that's going to play out in the adjuvant setting? Neil, any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that, like hair loss, rash is a visible manifestation of having cancer and being under treatment in this situation. And so conceivably, and we certainly don't have the data to know at this point, conceivably this outward manifestation of disease could impact patients' tolerance of therapy more so than in the advanced disease setting. And we're really just going to have to see how this plays out.
Anything that's coming along in terms of management of rash that's been effective or promising, Howard?
I don't know of any data. KGF, you were saying?
There's some anecdotal reports with keratinocyte growth factor given topically to try to prevent the acneiform rash, but there hasn't been a good clinical trial that's been reported.
Just tetracyclines and drying agents. Tetracyclines mainly. Doxycycline has been very effective.
What about in terms of rash predicting response with panitumumab? What do we know about that?
They're looking at it.
Everything shows there's a relationship.
The Peters data did show that.
I mean, every study has shown it. So.
But there are plenty of people that get the rash who don't respond.
No,
in fact,
that's
the majority.
True. But if you don't have a rash, you're a lot less likely to respond.
It was interesting, though, in the cetuximab approval, FDA would not look at it as another marker because there were enough cases that were contradictory. But with the panitumumab trial, I think they're actually conducting it much better to collect the data that will be necessary to be able to answer it prospectively.
Or even photographing.
Dan?
Yeah, certainly in respect to the rash, I think a couple of things. One is that it's been my experience looking at other practices, including my own, is that dose modifications and delays are not taken as often as they should be. And you see people blithely marching through 250 per meter squared per week with a grade 3 rash and on an antibiotic and multiple other treatments for something that could easily be allayed, recognizing that rash may be associated with response, pushing too much of a good thing. One other thing is from the rash standpoint, since it is a weekly treatment, one thing that a couple of our patients do is if we're going to maybe withhold treatment is they send us their picture on their cell phone that morning and say, should I bother driving from Scranton or Reading? We do this with capecitabine. If we see their hands, if they have hand-foot syndrome and we wouldn't treat them, why have them come all the way down? And then we photograph it and put it in the chart.
Anything more about why there is a correlation between rash and response?
They might just be immunocompetent people.
Well, it could be a manifestation of receptor saturation.
They might be healthier people.
Receptor saturation?
Is one possibility.
Cheap pharmacokinetics.
Wait. They might be healthier people?
Yeah, the basic fact is that healthier people do better with therapies. They appear to be healthier people to start with. So
the ones that have rash?
Read the Bond trial data. They suggest that they're actually healthier people to start with that actually got it. They got the rash.